for VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda denies it is clandestinely supporting M23 rebels in eastern DRC.
There is no way the government of Uganda can involve itself in any way or manner in propagating or encouraging violence in this region. The Great Lakes region, or for anywhere for that matter.
Experts say South Africa's international relations could change dramatically depending on which parties are in a coalition government. Another female presidential hopeful says she has been denied participation in Rwanda's July presidential and parliamentary elections. The Nile River is suffocating with waste. The Malawi government has announced a funeral arrangement for Vice President Saulos Chilima, who died Monday in a plane crash.
Sunday, there will be a public service, and thereafter, there will be departure for Nshewu, that's the home district of the late vice president, where a burial will take place on Monday, the 17th.
And Biden and Trump are at odds over gun control. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations panel of experts has accused Uganda of clandestinely offering support to M23 rebels who are currently engaged in an all-out war against Democratic Republic of Congo troops in the eastern part of the country. The Uganda Monitor reports the panel of experts says Uganda has allowed the M23 and other rebel leaders to evade international sanctions, including hosting them. Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, OEM Henry Okello, says the accusations are baseless. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that, on the contrary, Uganda has been trying to bring about peace and stability in the region.
Accusing Uganda of helping the M23 rebels, that is the biggest rubbish and wogohosh that I've heard. That report, if that is what is intended to accuse the government of Uganda, it should be treated with the biggest disrespect one can find. There is no way the government of Uganda, this government of Uganda, can involve itself in any way or manner in propagating or encouraging violence in this region, the Great Lakes region, or for anywhere for that matter. To the contrary, this government is known for going out of its way and sacrificing its little resources in millions of dollars, sacrificing its human resources to bring peace and tranquility in the Great Lakes and the whole of Africa.
How would you describe Uganda's relationship with DRC? Because the government in Kinshasa seems to agree with this panel's report.
Our relationship with the DRC government is very cordial, very warm. Suffice to say that it is this kind of reporting that is used by our enemies and enemies of the region to bring division and mischief amongst us. In the absence of such a report, you will not have any sort of tension or misunderstanding amongst our people. But this is the long-term agenda of some of the international players who do not want to see peace in this region, who benefit from the conflict in this region. These actors have been around for long, and they have never wanted peace in the Congo, and they use all kind of mechanisms, including the so-called UN specialist report to bring a mischief amongst good neighbors and good friends.
And lastly, Mr. Minister, how do you act to the assertion by some that it's Congo's mineral wealth that is
These are not new assertions. These assertions by the so-called UN specialists have been around for so long. They keep renewing it, reframing it, recreating it, and remanufacturing it and republishing it. You go back to the history. That is the first time they've done this. Just at a time when things seem to be going to normality, just at a time when things seem to be going well, then what do they do? They throw in such a report in order to bring confusion and disruption in this region. And they benefit from it because the DRC has never had peace since these actors killed the leadership like Patrice Lumumba and then intervened in the DRC from the time of independence. The same actors are today continuing to create such mischief so that DRC never gets peace, and this region is always in conflict just because of the enormous mineral resources and the opportunities that are here that they don't have access to and don't wish to have access to.
Oyem Henry Okello is Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. He spoke from Kampala with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. The Malawi government has announced the funeral arrangements for Vice President Saulos Chilima, who died Monday in a plane crash, along with eight other Malawian government officials. The government also says the Malawi military will launch an investigation into the cause of the crash. Information Minister Moses Kunkuyu tells me the funeral will take place on Monday, June 17.
We're just walking out of a cabinet meeting now where the whole program has been concretized. And the flow of events will be that on Friday, that's on the 14th, the body of the late vice president will be taken from the morgue and it will go via a church mass right in the city of Lilongwe. And thereafter, it will lie in state for 2 days. That's on Friday and on Saturday. Then on Sunday, there will be a public service where members of the general public will be able to join. And thereafter, there will be departure for Nshewu, that's the home district of the late vice president. That's about 2 hours' drive from the capital city going southwards, where burial will take place on Monday the 17th.
Is it true, Minister, that the government, together with the family, you're hiring or you're going to engage private medical experts to conduct autopsy? And what will be the purpose?
That is very true. Whenever there is such death caused by an accident, there are rules that are followed. From the military, they do institute their own inquiry. The police also does conduct all these autopsies. But in this case, we also got requests from some of the families that apart from there being a requirement from the police that autopsies be conducted, but there was that interest as well that there should be this kind of autopsies, and it's normal. So government gave a go-ahead and requested that the families would be involved in the identification of the pathologists to conduct the autopsy, and government to foot the cost. So in liaison with the families, indeed, autopsies will be conducted on all the bodies, and thereafter the bodies will be taken for burial. Only one body has been claimed today and has been given burial in line with the Islamic burial rites. But all the others, the autopsies are currently being done so that tomorrow they could be taken to their respective homes for burial.
In terms of what caused the accident, does your government intend to investigate?
Yes, the Malawi Defense Force announced today that they have a board that is going to engage in their investigations. They are doing the inquiry and they are commencing their work tomorrow. But they have been on the scene. They have been gathering forensic details that will help in their inquiry. But they have given us in 10 days, they should be able to come up with something.
Moses Kunkuyu is Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Another female presidential hopeful says she has been denied participation in Rwanda's July 2024 presidential and parliamentary elections. This, as the Rwandan Electoral Commission is set to announce the final list of approved candidates on Friday, June 14. Already denied is Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza, because the authorities say she has been convicted and imprisoned. Now, Diane Rigara says she has been rejected for several reasons, including a lack of signatures from some of her supporters, a lack of proof of no criminal record, and documentary proof of citizenship. Rigara tells me that she is disappointed because she has done all she can to meet the requirements.
The Electoral Commission has said that I have not fulfilled all the requirements.
What are some of the requirements?
Well, one big requirement was collecting signatures. And like in 2017, the Electoral Commission has said that my signatures were not authentic. Therefore, they will not accept my candidacy. So that's the reason they gave. And I'm very disappointed in that decision because I put so much effort and time into the process. And I believe what I provided was right. Like in 2017, like 7 years ago, I did all I could to fulfill all the requirements.
But the Elections Commission says that some of the people you have on your list of supporters did not have signatures.
That's what they said, but I think they did not want me to be on that list. They did not want me to campaign. So they had to find a reason for me not to be on the list. And they came up with that. That's the same reason they gave in 2017. So I'm very disappointed, but it is what it is.
As you said, you ran again in 2017. Did the Elections Commission or the government say to you that you have a criminal record? Besides the issue of your signatures, what else do they have against you?
They also say either that I did not being from Rwanda. That's number one. And they also said that I did not prove that I had no criminal record. In both cases, I am Rwandese. Both of my parents were born here. I was born here, and I do not have any criminal record. Yes, I was in prison for 1 year, but I was cleared of all charges. So I do not have a criminal record.
And did you prove that to the Elections Commission that you do not have a criminal record?
Yes, I did. That I had been cleared of all the charges back in 2018. I provided them with what was needed, whether it was for my citizenship or whether it was for the criminal record. And when I went to submit my documents last week, they say that all that was left for me to submit was a medical certificate and the proof that I had no other citizenship, and I provided them with that.
I mean, Rwanda has many female officials, or let's say in parliament. If you ran for parliament, would you have the same problems you are having now, running for president?
I haven't thought yet about the other option, because my objective, my aim was to run as a presidential candidate, and I was just denied that.
Diane Rwigara is an aspiring presidential candidate for Rwanda's presidential and parliamentary elections, which are scheduled to take place in July. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 13th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. International relations experts say South Africa's foreign policy could change dramatically depending on which parties are in a coalition government. The African National Congress's recent poor election results mean it cannot govern alone as it has since 1994. The ANC's lack of a significant majority in parliament also means it no longer can call the shots in foreign policy. Darren Taylor reports.
Foreign policy differences between the African National Congress and its likely biggest partner in government, the Democratic Alliance, DA, are glaring. An example is their stances on Israel's war in Gaza. The DA's statements on the conflict often highlight Israel's right to defend itself against what the party describes as the terrorists of the Hamas militant group. The ANC, on the other hand, calls Israel an apartheid state guilty of genocide in Gaza. It has close relations with Hamas, calling it a liberation movement. The ANC-led government has filed a war crimes case against Israel in the International Court of Justice. Nordic Africa Institute researcher Henning Melba says although the ANC's foreign policies are distasteful to many in the West, they've placed Africa on the map.
Last year, the summit in South Africa received huge international attention. And, of course, more recently, the South African claim against Israel in the International Court of Justice. All of these markers are in question if the ANC is not any longer the sole party in government. And it much depends with whom they enter the coalition.
The DA considers some members of the BRICS bloc, notably China, Iran and Russia, as authoritarian human rights abusers. The ANC government drew criticism from the United States and European Union because it has continued military training with Russia despite its invasion of Ukraine, which has been widely condemned internationally. Independent international relations analyst Angela Muvumba says the ANC support for Hamas and the party's BRICS allies haven't endeared it to countries like the US.
There are aspects of the South African foreign policy that have really resisted the categorization of some states as pariah states or authoritarian states by other states that also behave a bit badly. So when the US calls Iran an authoritarian state and wishes to kind of shame South Africa in terms of its relationships with Iran or with China or with Russia, South Africa bristles. I think the election may change how much it bristles, depending on who gets into coalition government with the ANC.
Melba says South Africa's foreign policy will change should the DA get a significant say in government. The ANC's other possible coalition partners, the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, and Umkhonto weSizwe, MK, are vehemently anti-West. Both have suggested breaking ties with the US in particular, describing it as neo-colonialist. The EFF and MK want closer ties with Beijing, Moscow and Tehran, and with anti-Western governments across the world, from Cuba to Venezuela to North Korea. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa's opposition Inkatha Freedom IFP party on Wednesday announced it will ally with the ruling African National Congress ANC as it seeks to build a governing coalition following the elections. The new parliament in Cape Town is to convene for the first time tomorrow, Friday, after the vote produced no outright winner. The IFP won 17 seats in the 400-member National Assembly, where lawmakers will be called to appoint a speaker and elect the country's president. The ANC, with 159 seats, has already indicated it wants to form a government of national unity with a broad group of parties, ranging from the far right to the hard left. Africa's longest river flows through 11 countries, helping to sustain more than 200 million people directly or indirectly. However, the very lifeblood of these nations is under threat from increasing human activity upstream that poses a significant risk to the River Nile's fragile ecosystem. Sheila Pony reports from Boa in Jonglei State, South Sudan.
The Nile River is the second largest river in the world. It provides crucial resources to 11 countries, including South Sudan, the world's youngest nation. Lueth Ring, Lueth Executive Director at Community Action Against Plastic Waste in South Sudan, says, as dawn breaks each day over this ancient river, its waters carry a silent plea at the center of a 21st century environmental challenge.
The river cries out, choked by the bare hands it feeds. We stand here today to silence that cry, to transform habits and to introduce sustainable solutions for our people.
Community Action Against Plastic Waste is a youth-driven NGO. Lueth, the organization's founder, says this once majestic, ancient lifeline for civilization is now facing a severe environmental threat.
The Nile is bleeding red, not with blood, but with plastic and waste that suffocated waters. Our town, river, and future are all interconnected. The situation here in Bor is dire and is our duty to act.
Environmental experts predict that more frequent and intense heat waves could cut the Nile's flow by a surprising 75% and spark conflicts over water resources and food insecurity. and heighten health risks related to inadequate water supply and sanitation. Joseph Africano Batal is South Sudan's Undersecretary of the Ministry of Environment and Forestry Management. He explained the importance that water quality has for all those who live and work near the banks of the Nile.
People drink water directly from the Nile or from the streams, resulting into cholera, diarrhea, and other waterborne diseases. So the only solution to improve the quality of water in South Sudan is to establish liquid, solid, and medicinal waste management.
Les believes a good beginning would be for the government to facilitate workshops to teach effective waste management, implement policies that discourage single-use plastic consumption, and provide tracks to regularly collect waste from people who live along the riverbank, like this teenage boy.
So the reason why we are here, we are cleaning the riverside. It is our lifeline. So it is to protect us from the other diseases.
In the longer term, community action against plastic waste envisions regular waste collection,
The Oklahoma Supreme Court has dismissed a lawsuit of the last two survivors of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre who were seeking reparations. The Associated Press reports that the nine-member court on Wednesday upheld the decision made by a district court in Tulsa last year. In this year's presidential campaign, guns continue to divide Americans. President Joe Biden wants a ban on assault weapons. His opponent, Donald Trump, says Biden is threatening the constitutional rights of gun owners. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports that the president spoke about guns on a day when his son was convicted of lying about his drug use to illegally buy a gun.
President Joe Biden told gun control activists in Washington Tuesday that he needs their help to strengthen gun laws.
We need you to overcome the unrelenting opposition of the gun lobby, gun manufacturers, so many politicians when they oppose common sense gun legislation.
Biden called for a federal ban on assault weapons and criticized Republican opponents for trying to close the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, which is responsible for fighting gun crime.
You can't be pro-law enforcement and say you are pro-law enforcement and be pro-abolishing the AFT. You can't do it. It's outrageous.
Nearly a third of Americans say they have a gun, according to the Pew Research Center. Donald Trump told America's largest gun lobby in May that Biden wants to take away those guns.
If the Biden regime gets four more years, they are coming for your guns, 100% certain.
Trump says gun rights in the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment would be guaranteed by his election, but threatened by Biden's election.
If they get in, our country is going to be destroyed in so many ways, but the Second Amendment will be, it's under siege. But with me, they never get anywhere.
Trump told the National Rifle Association that gun owners will make him a winner in November.
These are great patriots. These are great people. And we're going to do things like nobody can believe. We're going to win this election at levels that nobody's ever seen before.
Trump's record on gun control as president is reason not to reelect him, Biden says.
My predecessor told the NRA convention recently. He's proud that, quote, I did nothing on guns when I was president. And by doing nothing, he made the situation considerably worse.
Biden spoke about guns Tuesday on the same day his son Hunter was convicted on charges including illegally purchasing a gun. Joe Biden did not speak about his son's convictions, but did issue a written statement saying he'll accept the outcome of this case and continue to respect the judicial process. Hunter Biden is the first child of a sitting U.S. president to be convicted of a crime, and is scheduled to stand trial on separate federal tax fraud charges in September. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a great day and please be safe whatever you do.